Who are these obviously much younger looking people in this photo? Definitely not. No, that is actually, in fact, me. I had a little, my hair wasn't as long, but I had a little more of it. It's a little less gray. But anyway, this picture is 8 years old, or at least it will be on Monday. Monday, Adi and I will be celebrating 8 awesome years together. And it has been pretty awesome. And unfortunately, we weren't able to celebrate because we have kids. And if you have young kids, you know that you are sick 24/7. So she's at home sick with the kids. But the Tillers brought us some cheesecake. So it all works out. But I've been reflecting on our marriage and really on our wedding. I'm not really a sentimental kind of guy. In fact, people were begging us for months to post our wedding photos online. Because I'm just not that type of guy who wants to, I don't know. So I'm not super sentimental. I don't want to broadcast all these wedding photos. But we did, and it's actually been kind of fun. I'm thankful that we do have them to go back and reflect on our marriage, on our wedding day. And really also think about the time leading up to it. And I know there's some engaged couples in here tonight. First of all, congratulations. Second, you're also probably experiencing what we were experiencing leading up to getting married, which is a little bit of fear, right? A little bit of maybe uncertainty. Not uncertainty in the realm of like, am I going to marry this person? Obviously, you know that. You proposed. You know them enough that, you know, I knew Adi enough that I chose to ask her to marry me. She didn't know me well enough because she said yes. But anyway, you know, you have all these questions. What's life going to be like once we get married? Are our finances going to be okay? Where are we going to live? What's it going to be like when we have kids? Where am I going to work? Are we going to have to move? What's that going to look like? What's life going to look like? What's ministry going to look like? And as you're engaged, they say, you know, don't have any expectations or anything like that, but you just can't help it anyway. But anyway, it's the day of your wedding, and you have all these questions and these concerns and these expectations. But I tell you what, when you're up there and you see your wife walk down the aisle, or, you know, if you're the woman and you are walking down that aisle, guess what? You don't have any questions anymore. You are excited. You are thrilled. Yes, there's still some uncertainty, but that doesn't matter anymore. All of that just kind of pales into comparison compared to the fact that this is my wife. Oh my God, you see her in all her glory. And it's just a beautiful experience. And since then, we've had some awesome experiences as a married couple as well. We've gone on some awesome trips together. We've really bonded. We've had moments of just like these shared experiences that really do define and solidify our relationship. And I'm thankful for those experiences for two reasons. One, because it brings me back to reality. When you've been married, I've only been married 8 years. There's people here who have been married much longer than me. And it's hard. Marriage gets hard. You throw kids into the picture, it gets even harder. But you have these moments where you have these beautiful experiences and it brings you back to reality. Yeah, this is hard. Yes, I don't exactly know where this is going. Yes, there's these frustrations or these confusions. But man, this is awesome. And I have this moment where I remember this is my wife. And she is choosing to love me and I am choosing to love her. So I'm grateful for these experiences. For one, it brings me back to reality. And two, it's motivation to keep going. Because it does get hard. Life does get tough. But as a married couple, you can look back on these experiences and you can remember why you got married. You can remember where you're headed. You can remember all these aspects about your relationship together and Christ being at the center of it. And this propels you forward. But here's the problem, I think, a lot of times with marriages or relationships is we chase these experiences. We want to just constantly have these awesome, exciting experiences. But the problem with that is they're not guaranteed to happen. And if you just chase excitement all the time, you're doomed to fail. You're doomed to be disappointed because we're human after all. And that's why so many marriages fail today. It's because they're just trying to capture the excitement. That's all they care about is the excitement and these experiences. Now, God created marriage, and I think there's a lot of parallels between, you know, marriage and our relationship with Christ. And one that I've been drawing on here is our experiences and our walk with the Lord, right? Often we have questions. We have frustrations. We don't know where things are headed in our walks with the Lord. But the Lord will provide these experiences for us that do those two things, where they bring us back to reality, they remind us who God truly is, and they motivate us to keep going. They motivate us to press on when things get hard and when times get tough. And this is exactly where we find the disciples in Matthew. They're kind of in this engagement phase. They've been walking with Christ for a while in his public ministry. They've been asking questions. They've been trying to learn who he is. We had this conversation last week that I'll talk about, you know, of Peter proclaiming that Christ is the Messiah. But then Jesus does this thing where he talks about dying, and that's confusing and upsetting, and the disciples don't exactly get that. But he provides for them an experience here in chapter 17 that puts everything kind of in perspective. But anyway, where we left off, Matthew 16, starting in verse 15, Jesus is having this conversation with the disciples about who people believe he is. And then he turns the question to them and says, who do you say I am? And Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, blessed are you, you're right. And not only that, but the Lord, my Father, revealed this to you. So then Jesus says, yes, you're right. I am the Messiah. And I have to go die. And Peter says, God forbid it. This shall never happen to you. And Jesus responds, get behind me, Satan. So you see this confusion. These two perspectives aren't compatible. Peter proclaims that you're the Messiah. And for the disciples and the Jewish people at the time, the Messiah was this promised king that was going to come and rule forever. But then Jesus talks about dying. And I don't know if you know this, but typically you need to be alive to rule a government and to rule a group of people. So how can this work? What does all of this mean? How can you establish your kingdom? And then we end with this last chapter. Truly, I say to you, there are some who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Okay, you have these questions. You have these concerns. Let me show you something. Now, you also have to remember, chapter breaks aren't inspired. They're just, you know, someone along the line put these chapter breaks in place. And we have an unfortunate chapter break here because Jesus Christ has this announcement to his disciples. Let me show you something. And then immediately after, we get into this. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and his brother and led them up on a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. Jesus Christ was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his garments became as white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them. Talking with Christ. So here we have, 6 days after this event, this discussion of who Jesus Christ is, Jesus is like, all right, guys, I want to show you something. So he takes Peter, James, and John up a mountain, and they have this absolutely wild experience. Jesus Christ is transfigured, transformed right before them. He is shining as bright as the sun. And these poor guys, because it says here in Luke that Peter and James and John, they were really sleepy. They were heavy with sleep, but they became fully awake when they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. So they just climbed a mountain. They're trying to take a nap. And then Jesus Christ, with the brightness of the sun, starts radiating right in front of them. I have one of these like gentle alarm clocks that like slowly gets brighter as it gets closer to your alarm. It's supposed to ease you into being awake. It's like this pleasant experience over like 20 minutes. It gets a little bit brighter and then birds start chirping and you wake up and you're like, ah, yes, I'm awake. That wasn't the experience here. They got like, this is like I'm sleeping and then the sun, the actual sun is in my room and now I'm awake. And the word here for transfigure is where we get the word metamorphosis. And what's really happening here is an inward reality is transforming an outward appearance. It's not like the sun and the moon, where the moon is bright, but it's just reflecting the light from the sun. It's not that Jesus Christ is radiating and glowing bright like this because God is like casting a beam of light down on Jesus and he's wearing reflective clothing and it just bounces off of him. Jesus Christ is radiating light and from the inside, from the reality of who he is. So what's happening on top of this mound is the curtain is pulled back, and Jesus is showing and shining who he truly is. So actually, the miracle here is not the transfiguration itself. The miracle here isn't the fact that Jesus Christ was shining as bright as the sun. The miracle is that God's glory is stuffed inside a human carpenter. And for a brief moment on the top of the mountain, that reality that Christ is the Son of God and all of his deity and awesomeness is revealed to these disciples. This has to be what Paul experienced in Acts 9, right? It says that Paul was struck blind by a bright light from heaven. He saw the awesomeness of Christ and it blinded him. Anyway, if you're these three, Peter, James, and John, this is a weird experience. This is wild. What is happening here is just like almost hard to describe. It's like there's kind of the words that he used here are just so blunt because how do you convey the awesomeness of what's happening here? But what's even weirder than the fact that Jesus Christ is shining like this is the fact that there's two dudes here who died a long, long time ago. And these two dead dudes, well, technically, Elijah never died. But these two dudes who are really, 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 really old are standing there on top of this mountain talking to Jesus. That's crazy. And wouldn't it be kind of interesting to be a fly on the wall during that conversation? Man, wouldn't you want to know, like, Moses and Elijah and Jesus are talking. What in the world are they talking about? Man, I would love to know that. Oh, wait, we actually do know that. It says here in cross-reference in Luke 30, and behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appearing in his glory were speaking of Christ's departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. So Moses and Elijah and Jesus, of all of the things that they could be talking about, are talking about Jesus Christ's death. Doesn't that, I mean, that relays the severity of Christ's mission here, right? That these guys are talking to Christ about his departure, him going to Jerusalem to die. So anyway, here we are at the top of the mountain with Jesus radiating like the literal sun with Moses and Elijah. So what do the disciples do? Peter, of course, said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll make three tabernacles or tents here, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, a bright cloud overshadowed them. Behold, a voice out of the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down on the ground and were terrified. And Jesus came to them and touched them and said, "Get up and do not be afraid." And lifting their eyes, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. Which, first of all, at the end of that, how beautiful is it that in their moment of like abject terror, because Peter just got interrupted by the literal voice of God, Jesus Christ shows his humanity. And he comes over and he touches them and says, "It's all right, guys. You can stand up. We'll be okay." So, of course, who else but Peter chimes in? He has to say something. And there's a lot of people trying to discern what is it that he's talking about. This was probably, could potentially have been around the time of the Festival of Booths, aka the Booth Party. Perhaps they wanted to celebrate the Festival of Booths on top of this mountain. Let's build these tabernacles so that we can celebrate this Jewish festival here. I mean, why would we not want to do that? And maybe that's possible. But we got another cross-reference in Mark that says, after Peter said this, he didn't know what to say. They were so frightened. Peter just was like, dozing off. Then the sun was in his face, and he looks up and sees Jesus and Moses and Elijah. And he's like, hey, guys, I was thinking about building some tents. Do you want one? What kind of tent do you want? Do you want a Coleman tent? I got an extra cot. Do you need a cot? And then in the middle of this discussion of tents, I wish I had Carlisle's voice right now. The literal voice of God says, this is my son. Stop. Listen to him. Okay. I get it. No tent. I'm sorry. But, throughout the Old Testament, whenever we see the presence of God, it comes in this form, this giant cloud, the presence of God. And it's pretty awesome that he conceals himself in this way. Again, we see in the awesomeness of Jesus Christ, yet he has emptied himself to be into human form. And we see God could do more than just scare these guys, but he chooses to just show some restraint. He chooses, yes, to scare them, but he has kind of obscured his presence. In other words, there is awesome power and authority present here in God, in the presence of God. And it's also pretty amazing that this awesome power and authority that is present here is also present in us believers. When it says we have power and authority, this is a glimpse into the type of power and authority we have. This also, Peter's response here, gives us some insight into how humanity, how people, how we typically try to respond to moments like this. And the response is more or less to, like, let's set up a religion, right? Let's religify this. Let's build some tents. I don't want this to end. Let's build a monument. Let's do something special here. And throughout history, the church does this, where it tries and takes these things and turns them into religion, takes a relationship with Jesus Christ and turns it into religion. We have our monuments and we have our rituals. But all that's doing is diluting the reality of who God is. All that's doing is minimizing his glory. And the point here that God is interrupting is it's not, let's establish these monuments, but rather, this is my son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. That's God's point here. Listen to Jesus Christ. But okay, why Moses and Elijah? If you've been around for a while, if you're somewhat familiar with the Bible, you've probably heard about these guys, Moses and Elijah. They're pretty important dudes. Why is it that of all the people to appear at the top of this mountain, it's Moses and Elijah? Well, Moses, when you think of the law, you think of Moses. Often that's what it's referred to as, the law of Moses, the Old Testament law of Moses. Moses also wrote the first five books of the Old Testament. And then you have Elijah, who set up the prophetic line. You have Elijah, the first prophet. And these are both people, Moses and Elijah, that were highly revered amongst the Jewish population. And what we have captured here in the presence of Moses and Elijah is the entire Old Testament. The law and the prophets are summarized in Moses and Elijah, and they are both here. And what are they talking about? They're talking about Jesus Christ dying. They're talking about Jesus Christ's death. Everything in the Old Testament all pointed to Jesus Christ. The law, the sacrificial system, the need for someone and something to pay for your sins, the prophetic idea and the prophecies about a Messiah coming to rule. All of this is pointing to Jesus Christ, and all of it is represented here in these two. Jesus Christ himself says in John 5, 39 and 46, "You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life. It is these that testify about me. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me." So Jesus is saying, this Old Testament, this book that you read, this book that you swear by, that you testify about, all of it points to me. All of it finds its fulfillment in me. So these guys are a big deal. Moses and Elijah, the fact that they're there is a big deal. I kind of understand Peter's response oh my God, this is tremendous. Let's do something about this. But what does God do? He says, this is my son. Listen to him. It's all about Jesus Christ now. Everything has transitioned to being about Jesus Christ. It's cool for us being on the other side of this, on the other side of history, on the other side of the crucifixion, because we can go back and we can read the law and we can read the prophets and we can see how all of that points to Jesus Christ. Actually, my personal devotional time, I realized a couple months ago that, you know, I haven't actually read a lot of the prophets in a while. Like, it's been a while since I've read Habakkuk and Malachi, right? How often are we reading these obscure minor prophets in the Old Testament? So I don't, that's something I've been doing in my devotional life, is reading through these prophets in the Old Testament. And you read something like Isaiah, and man, it is filled to the brim with references to Jesus Christ. You read these prophets and you just see that this is all clearly pointing to Jesus Christ. And that's something that's, it's an awesome task for us to do, is to go back with this hindsight, with this vision now, and read the Old Testament. And something that I encourage you guys to do. It's cool. Like, we're in our home churches, in our fellowship groups, a lot of us are going through Genesis to see how all of this points to Jesus Christ someday. So anyway, remember, you know, Peter and company, their confusion. What's going on? You say you're the Messiah, but you say you're going to die. How does that work? How does all that line up? Now, obviously, they still don't have all of the answers. And I'm sure they're still confused. And actually, right after this, they have some more questions. But what they do know is that they are called to listen to him. Listen to Jesus Christ. What has he been saying? What is he going to say? What is he currently saying? Listen to him. So anyway, the light show's done, and now they're leaving. And we have here them descending the mountain. So as they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, "Tell this vision to no one until the Son of Man has risen from the dead." So what you just saw, don't tell anybody until the Son of Man rose from the dead. And the disciples ask him, why do the scribes talk about Elijah? Why do they say that Elijah must come first? And he answered and said, Elijah is coming and will restore all things, but I say to you that Elijah already came. And they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they wished. So as the Son of Man is going to suffer, so also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he had spoken to them about John the Baptist. So they still, again, have questions. They're still trying to understand this. And there's a prophecy in the Old Testament in Malachi, Malachi 4. The last paragraph of the Old Testament in Malachi 4:5 talks about the coming of Elijah. Before the great and terrible day of the Lord, I will send Elijah. Now, they just saw Elijah. So what does that mean? How does this all pan out? And Jesus Christ draws the connection between Elijah and John the Baptist. Elijah did come. Elijah proclaimed the coming of the Lord. And that was John the Baptist. And they did what they wanted with him. They executed him. And there's still some debate. Even now you read commentators, is Elijah going to come back before the second coming? Someone in the spirit of Elijah. And we don't exactly know, but what we do know here are the facts that Jesus Christ came to suffer and to die and to rise again. That's what he came here to accomplish. That was Jesus Christ's purpose. Now, if he were to actually establish his kingdom at this point in time, this is what the disciples want. I want you to establish your rule here and now. The problem with that, of establishing his kingdom here, is it would be a population of one, and that would be Jesus Christ. Because the presence of God demands perfection. Yet there is sin that exists as a barrier between all of us. None of us can stand in the presence of the Lord as sinners. So before he can establish his kingdom, first, he had to establish a way to deal with sin. He had to do something about the presence of sin. And how did he do that? How did God accomplish that? He accomplished that through Jesus Christ, through his death and resurrection. a lot of people, myself included, before I came to know Christ, but a lot of people who don't know the Lord or don't know what Christianity is all about have this misconception that Christianity is about being good. It's about doing the right things. It's about being a good person. I'd be willing to bet if many of us have conversations with friends of ours who aren't believers, if you ask them how to get into heaven, and maybe you even think this yourself, how do you get into heaven? You just got to be a good person. That's what, I mean, you have to do the right thing. I know you're going to mess up every once in a while, but generally you have to be a good person, at least better than other people, at least better than most people. And the bar starts to move a little bit, right? It's kind of hard to pin down how good of a person do you need to be. But if this is the case, if all of it takes is to be a good person, to be granted entrance into eternity with God in heaven, then why did Jesus Christ come to die? Why did Elijah and Moses talk about Jesus Christ dying? If all it takes is being right, if all it takes is performance, then Jesus Christ died for no reason. Yet Moses and Elijah talked about the necessity of Christ dying. They talked about his plan of redemption. They talked about his death. This is what the Bible says about what it looks, or how you come into relationship with Christ. A man is not justified by the works of the law, but through faith in Christ Jesus. So if you're here tonight and you have a misconception on what it means to get into heaven, on what it means to be a Christian, I assure you, and Jesus Christ assures you, and the Bible itself assures you that it's not about being a good person. It's about coming into a relationship with Jesus Christ. It's about acknowledging that he died on the cross to pay for your sins. The death that we deserve, Christ paid for. And he gave us an opportunity to know him and to know the Lord through accepting his death on the cross. So Peter and John and James, they all had this tremendous mountaintop experience. And what's fascinating is they all, well, Peter and John write about it later. James was martyred. You read about him being martyred in Acts. He was the first disciple to be martyred. But 35 years later, after this experience, Peter writes about it. And at this point, Peter is facing persecution, jail. He's on his way to becoming martyred. And he writes in 2 Peter 1, "For when he received," talking about Christ here, "when he received honor and glory from God the Father, such an utterance as this was made to him by the majestic glory, 'This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased.' And we ourselves heard this utterance made from heaven when we were with him on the holy mountain." Peter writes about this experience 35 years later. John, in the Gospel of John, John 1 is just a tremendous chapter. And it talks about the light and the Word, and the presence of God, and this Word becoming flesh. And it says in John 1:14, "We saw his glory." We saw the glory of Jesus Christ, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. So obviously this experience on the mountaintop had a significant impact on these guys, on Peter and James and John. They're writing about it. Years later, as Peter is getting ready to go to his death, he is writing about this. John uses this in his declaration of the awesomeness of Jesus Christ in John 1. And it's also obvious that this mountaintop experience was created and facilitated for these guys. If you read through this passage again, who do you think it's about? Was the transfiguration to benefit Jesus? Was the transfiguration to benefit Elijah or Moses? Was it there for their edification? But you read this and it says, Jesus Christ took them up the mountain. Jesus Christ led them up the mountain. Before them, Jesus Christ was transfigured. When God the Father speaks through this booming cloud, who does he talk to? He talks to the disciples. And this is important because we're at this transitional point in Jesus's ministry, where now we begin our descent to Jerusalem, where Jesus Christ goes to die. These disciples and Jesus Christ have a long, dark road ahead of them. They're descending into Jesus' death. Their path will be filled undoubtedly with suffering, rejection. I guarantee you this experience helped with that, Help them endure this suffering. Even after Christ died, these are the guys that launched the movement. Peter is writing about this years later. Thank God for this moment. I got to see the glory of Christ. I assure you that this got these disciples through some tough times. Now, the question is for us, do we get these experiences? As a Christian, does God have these mountaintop experiences for us? And it's a complicated answer, but the short answer is yes. Maybe it's not with Moses and Elijah on the top of a mountain, but I do know that the Lord still gives us these experiences where he reveals to us the reality and the truth of who he is, and he encourages us to keep pressing on. We have these experiences where Jesus Christ can just break into our hearts. And at those moments, we see him for who he truly is. We see his power, his glory, his magnificence. And it's just a thrilling thing to have those personal encounters with the Lord, with Jesus Christ, where he leaves an impression on us. And it's something that, like Peter and John, that we can look back on for years. Man, remember that time with the Lord. Remember this experience I had with Jesus Christ. I know I've had these experiences. Again, maybe it doesn't look as physically bright as theirs, but I've had moments where I can't help but realize the Lord is here, the Lord is active, and he is awesome, and he is worth listening to. I know I myself have gone through a transformation, but there's also this thing in my cell right now where we got a couple new guys coming around. This is my small men's group. And I tell you what, seeing these people, these dudes, just like be on fire for the Lord, and to see where they came from, to see the people that they have been transformed into, I look at this growth, I look at these accomplishments, and it's like I see this. And yes, there is something to be said about these dudes. Like they have humility, they recognize their need for the Lord. But it's awesome to see this. And I recognize God is here. God is present. God is active. And I see this in their lives, and I rejoice. And I'm so thankful to have this experience where I see what the Lord is doing. And that encourages me, because now I see what the Lord is doing in their lives, and I want other people to experience it. And they're going through the same thing. They know what they're experiencing, and they want other people to experience that too. It's a beautiful thing. Sometimes God also gives us experiences when we're in the midst of maybe doubt or confusion. That's the position that Peter and the disciples found themselves in, remember? Like, they're confused. They're trying to put these pieces together. But they were seeking answers. You know, they were dialoguing with Christ. They're trying to understand. Jesus Christ is giving answers, but they still don't understand. And then God butts in. God the Father butts in. And what does he say? He says, listen to them. With us, I know myself, there have been times where I have been struggling with the Lord. I don't know what this means. I don't know how I'm going to make it through this. Lord, I don't know what you're doing here. I don't know how to make sense of this. And then God butts in and he says, Ian, would you just listen to him? And I say, yeah, but these tents. And he says, listen to him. This is my son. Listen to him. Romans 12:2. Tells us, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. The word used, the metamorpho, used for the transfiguration of Jesus Christ outside of the Gospels in this experience was used two times in the New Testament, once here in Romans 2:2. Transforming our minds, transformed by the renewing of our mind. The Lord wants to transform our minds. He wants to renew our minds. But he is calling on us to listen to him. But here's the problem, like I was talking about earlier with marriage and in our walks with the Lord. What if we just chase experiences? What if our walk with the Lord just becomes like, I want to experience these mountaintop explosions of light time and time and time again? You know, I'm just here to climb the mountain. I'm just here to see the transfiguration. And we begin to idolize these experiences. You know, I'm just here for the emotions. I guarantee you, you'll be disappointed. If we just chase experiences, I guarantee you we'll just be disappointed. And also, what happens in between these experiences? Okay, maybe you will have this awesome, jaw-dropping moment with the Lord. But what happens after that? Or what happens in between these experiences? Are we doing anything? I was talking to some guys the other day about Johnny and Friends. Johnny and Friends is an awesome opportunity to go serve, to be a short-term missionary for a week and help families with kids with disabilities. And everyone who comes home from this is like, that was a mountaintop experience. I have been transformed. I see who the Lord is. I see what God is doing. This is amazing. What if the response after that was, I can't wait to do nothing for the next 51 weeks so I can go back in 1 year and have my 1 week of spirituality. Just living for those experiences. But so often the opposite is true. These people come back and they say, wow, I have just witnessed the Lord. I have had a personal interaction with him and I have come back more energized than ever. What can I do? Where can I help? How can I pitch in? I don't care how monotonous it is. I don't care how boring it is. What service ministry opportunities do we have? I am on fire because I had this experience with the Lord, and I want that to translate into action now. Now, where Peter went wrong is Peter wanted to create his comfortable holy huddle. This is sweet. We got the three disciples, me and the two other disciples. We have Moses and Elijah and Christ. Let's just sit here. Let's just dwell in this moment. But Jesus Christ is saying, no, we have work to do. We have to go. Just a chapter before this, when Christ is talking about what it looks like to follow him, he says, you need to pick up your cross and follow me. Picking up your cross doesn't sound like an awesome experience, but that's what it looks like to follow the Lord, picking up our cross daily and following him. And it is awesome. Yes, it's hard. Yes, it's challenging, but there's nothing else I would rather do. And I know there's so many people here where there's nothing else they would rather do than pick up their cross daily and walk with him. That's what it looks like. It doesn't look like chasing experiences. It doesn't look like I'm just living for the next awesome moment, the next jolt of lightning to get me excited so that I can just do nothing. It looks like to walk with the Lord looks like picking up your cross daily. And hopefully this comes as somewhat of an encouragement to people here, because some people might feel alienated by this, confused, left out. Maybe you're wondering, where's my experience? Where's my mountaintop experience? Where's my bolt of lightning from the Lord? Where's my giant cloud? Where's my, you know, my bright shining sun? I don't have that. I haven't experienced that. Well, for one, I would say there were 12 disciples. Only three went up the mountain, joined the party of the other nine who weren't there, who didn't get this experience. And do you think that Christ loved them less? Do you think they were insignificant? Do you think that they didn't have a role to play? Do you think that Christ didn't care about them? No. Obviously, he did. Obviously, they were significant. Same with us. Okay, maybe you don't have that awesome experience. Does that mean the Lord loves you less? Does that mean you're insignificant, that he doesn't care about you? No. What we have to remember is the Lord doesn't promise us these experiences. He invited Peter and James and John to join him on this experience, but he doesn't promise us these experiences. He promises many other things for us: rest, significance, love, root, growth. If we continue to pursue the Lord, maybe someday we'll have an experience like this, but maybe we won't. But that's what faith is. Faith is walking regardless of the circumstances. Faith is walking regardless of how into it you feel or how energized you are. Faith is like, Lord, this is hard and I'm tired, but I know that you are worth following. I know that you are worth listening to. And also, if you're a believer, you might actually be in the middle of an experience right now. Like I said earlier, the word for transformed is used two other times. A Greek word is used two other times. Romans 12:2, and then we have here in 2 Corinthians 3:18. But we all with unveiled faces, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as from the Lord the Spirit. You are being transformed into the same image. You are a picture of glory. You are a shining light in the presence of the Lord. You are being miraculously transformed. That is a worthwhile experience. And that transformation in the lives of us believers should also remind us that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. This is my Son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. Our transformation is evidence that he is the Son of God and that he is worth listening to. And with that, I'll pray. And we'll call some people up. If you have some questions or comments, you can come up front and we'll handle those. Well, Lord, I want to just thank you so much for the transformation that you have been how you have been transforming us and the experiences that we have with you, Lord. And it's so tempting to just want to operate based on emotion or feeling or being into it or to be dependent on experiences, Lord. But I have seen the work that you've done, Lord, and I know that you are worth following and I know that you are worth listening to. And I thank you for the transformation of the lives that you have, the transformation in the lives that you have here before us, just reflecting on these people that you've put in our paths, Lord. I see the work that you're doing and I can't help but acknowledge that you are an awesome God. I just pray, Lord, that you can continue to edify us, Lord. You put these experiences in our lives for a reason, and I know that we also, much like the disciples, have a trial before us. We have long, tedious work. Ministry isn't often as fun, as exciting as we want it to be or as we think it can be, Lord, but I just thank you for the opportunity to do it and for this the significance that you give us because of that. And just pray for an edifying night tonight, Lord, and that we can just reflect on what you've been doing in our lives and how you've been transforming us. Amen. Oh, yeah, we got Neil. Do we have any comments?
Yeah.
Any comments? If not, Neil's got an update.
All right. I'll leave it. Thank you for this teaching, Ian. I really appreciated it. I think it's cool that we go through our lives and like, even though some of us like we might be chasing these mountaintop experiences, I have to question if maybe we ought to try to avoid them. Take for instance, like our three disciples going off the mountain. They have this amazing experience. They hear the voice of God. They hear this beautiful light. But I can't help but think about who was up there. You know, Peter. He's a knucklehead. I think that's safe to say. So I'm seeing it as like maybe he needed this huge, magnificent event so that he could listen. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, hey, you're following Jesus. Like, you're doing cool stuff, but like, listen to me. I'm yelling at you now. Here's what's gonna happen. Here's how we need you to act. And I was also thinking about Paul. Paul, before he came to Christianity, was actually persecuting Christians under the name Saul. And it got to a point where he had to have his own mountaintop experience. Christ appeared before him in a blinding light. He actually blinded Saul to get him to perk up and listen and change his mind and go on the right path. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how, like, what it looks like in individual people's lives, but I think at times like these grandiose mountaintop experiences are more course corrective than not.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I don't think we should avoid them. I think the fear is only pursuing them or just getting tied up in them. I think, yeah, these are course corrective moments. It was course corrective for Peter and James and John, but it also was edifying for them. And the Lord wants to give us these experiences to motivate us to keep going. And that's ultimately what happened, right? These guys, you keep reading this chapter, they descend the mountain and they get right back into the thick of it, right back into casting out demons and, you know, on their way to Jerusalem. But yeah, thanks for sharing that. What's up, Ben?
What's up? I've been realizing that often I would chase mountaintop experiences in my devotional life. You know, when you, you know, you sit down with your Bible and you're like, I need like God to reveal something I've never seen before, you know, just like something that nobody's understood yet. And I'm going to be the first to discover it, something like that. I've just been seeing that recently. I've been kind of realizing that that's an unrealistic expectation. And that really, I've been realizing that a lot of people that I admire their devotional life because, you know, you can tell that they're excited about things of the Lord. They've been reading and stuff. A lot of times they're excited about very simple things. And you know, they might share it. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I know that. Like, we've talked about it so many times. But they're excited about it because they're reminded of it by the Lord, and because they are like convicted by that simple thing. And I think that's the beauty of the gospel of the Bible, is like it's not always super complicated. It's a lot of times very simple things. But are we choosing to dwell on those? And so I've been trying to just, in my devotional life, try to dwell on like those simpler things and get excited about those things without looking for some new, you know, prophecy that's revealed to me or whatever. And that's been helpful. It just like try to get excited about the simple things of the Lord.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for sharing that. I mean, I struggle with that too. In reading and in teaching, like I'm going to teach this like no one's ever taught it before. But guess what? That's not the case. There's this guy called Billy Graham. And so many other greats, but it's like, it's not about that, you know, it's about listen to him. And, maybe I do need a lesson in simplicity, but yeah, thanks for sharing that, Ben. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Ian. Thank you for mentioning the folks who don't seem to have, or feel like they don't have, the mountaintop experiences that other people seem to. I find myself among them in a lot of ways. Life, I think for most people, is full of a number of disappointments. And I specifically remember going to Johnny and Friends after hearing the tales, the feelings, the breakthroughs. And I went there and it was a week and I came back and I was like, wait, where's my spiritual orgasm? It was a week and then it was done. And I was a little confused. But sort of reflecting on it a little bit, and there are other situations similar to that, I come to a passage in John chapter 20, where Jesus is talking with Thomas, the disciple who heard Jesus was back and was like, no, he's not. Yeah. And he said, I won't believe him until I can see him put my hands in the wounds that I saw him get. Mm-hmm. And in verse 27, Jesus comes in. It says, Then he said to Thomas, reach here with your finger and see my hands, and reach here your hand and put it into my side, and do not be unbelieving, but believing. Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. So at that point, he believes. Jesus said to him, because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed. So I don't know how to quantify that, but there's some quality to a faith that is strong and a belief in God, even though we might not see the same things or have the same mountaintop experiences as others do. And we might never know why this side of heaven. It might be that for person A who had this experience, it was so that they could tell person B who told person C who told person Z, and then person one got saved from that. We don't know.
Yeah.
God's plan 4D chess. Job never knew why his life went to absolute nothing and then came back. He was never told. But we can see many, many good things that came out of that. Yeah. So maybe that's just a bit of trying to help myself cope with not feeling good about following God all the time. But I think that there is hope for people who don't feel spiritual.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, because that's something that I have been grappling with when working on this, right? What about the people who don't have this experience? Does that make them less spiritual, less significant? So, yeah, thanks for sharing that. And we don't know what the Lord is doing. And also, we can, as a believer, all expect some sort of awesome experience. It might just happen on the other side of heaven. Who knows? Anyway, Neil.
No, I'm good. Hey, everyone. So I just wanted to give a quick update. IGL released a Christmas giving guide. So IGL, if you got, you guys know IGL, India Gospel League. We've partnered with them. We're sponsoring a village. Many of you sponsor kids, so their kid, Love One More kids program. So Christmas time is all about the kids. And so they've come up with this Christmas catalog that we've been asking for, actually. This is a really cool thing. I just wanted to let you guys know it exists. If you support one of the kids with IGL, you probably got this in the mail. It was like folded up like this and came in the mail. So I brought some with me if you don't have one. I also got a QR code you can scan if you want to give. But here's what it is. Okay, oh yeah. First of all, we're moving away from the Operation Christmas Child. And that's a cool thing. But here's the deal. We are already partnered with a really cool organization in IGL that they work locally, indigenously. They work with people the whole year. And so it makes like a really lot of sense for us to keep that partnership going. And for if people want to give extra at the holidays, which a lot of people seem to want to do, or you know, help with the children and give them a Christmas to remember, we can do that through IGL, who we're already partnered with, who already help the kids all year long, who know the kids, who love the kids, who get new kids out during their summer Bible studies and stuff like that, introducing them to Jesus. So the other thing is, like, donating to this, giving a gift over there with IGL, I mean, our dollars go a really long way in India compared to here. Buying goods here and shipping them over doesn't make quite as much sense as doing this through IGL, who we're already partnered with. So it's a good thing to just strengthen and keep our focus on our partner who we already have. So yeah, IGL supports the local markets, the local economy, reduces charitable dependency, and helps empower local leadership and keeping things moving there. So what do they got in the catalog there? So if you want to give, I got the QR code up. I'll have it there while I'm talking about what's in the catalog. But Corey is going to pop it up after CT2 if you want to scan it with your phone. It'll take you to a giving link on the IGL website. So the Christmas catalog. Obviously, we're going to be celebrating Christmas, okay? Every Love One More facility hosts Christmas celebration with a big dinner, so you can contribute to that, okay? So they've got these children's homes, and you can have a big Christmas dinner, help them put that on. That's very helpful to them. This is like holistic. This isn't just like a box of stuff being sent over, okay? This is like they're with them all year, you guys. So we can get these kids Bibles, okay? They're all about that. They lead with the gospel. Gifts, you know, crafts and gifts and sports equipment and dolls and jewelry, all that kind of fun stuff. You can give towards that, obviously. I mean, for Christmas, yeah, for sure. But educational stuff, they need that stuff. We can give towards that, too, for Christmas. I mean, our kids, you know, we probably get your kids art supplies and paper and stuff like that, too. Same kind of thing. And then other meals for, you know, lunch at school and stuff like that, some of the more regular needs. So you can give to all that kind of stuff there at that QR code. And then also that same link is in this, the paper version. I have that. I have a few of them. I don't have a ton for everybody, but we've got the link there. And I also wanted to give up just a quick update. I really just wanted to talk about the Christmas thing, but I did want to talk about our adoptive village. I'm not going to go into like a whole update on this. Maybe at the FST we'll do it like a full update. But I did want to just point out the fact that right now our giving on Rajakhadi, our adoptive village, we are giving like just exactly what we've committed to give. Okay, so it's like $1,250 a month. we are giving just that. So like previously, our villages, we would be giving double, and sometimes even a little bit more than double every month towards the village. So I did want to put that out there. It's like, well, maybe people don't know, or maybe people are tapped out, and that's okay, that's cool. But I just wanted to make sure you guys knew where we were at with the village. And if you want to give to it, you can email darlene.mccallum@iglworld. But I got another QR code if you want to do it that way, because I think that's the hip thing to do. I don't know if it is or not, but so you can take a picture of that and give to our village, our adoptive village, so that a monthly thing you can do. You can give it to it one at a time, or for a one-time gift. If you're doing that kind of end-of-year giving, that'd be a really cool thing to do. So, well, it's snowing today, so I guess it's like Christmas time, so 'tis the season. All right, that's all I got. Is there, if there's any questions, come see me after, and we'll talk about it. All right, cool? All right.